Last week, the topic I talked about was the Anapanasati Sutta, translated as the Mindfulness of Breathing Discourse. It's a core training aspect of Buddhism. I put it in the context of the Four Noble Truths doctrine in our concept and the Four Foundations of Mindfulness concept. And I was saying is that the Four Noble Truths concept kind of describes the structure of how life experience operates. And the Four Foundations concept provides a structure for understanding how all the different pieces of the selfing process interact with one another in the body sensations, feeling tones, emotions, the quality of conscious awareness, and what's actually streaming through conscious awareness. Those are the four foundations. But one of the aspects of the Four Noble Truths, the Noble Eightfold Path, is what's called right mindfulness. And that's the four foundations of mindfulness. But what that the Anapanasati Sutta does is it dives into right mindfulness in ways that are deeper than the four foundations of mindfulness. It's a training discipline. So the other two provide a sort of conceptual understanding. But this is really training, and it's crucial. So the guided meditation that preceded this talk tonight, I tried to bring attention to or make suggestions about what are called the four tetrads of the mindfulness breathing discourse. And the first tetrad develops mindfulness of the body, the second one mindfulness of feelings, the third one mindfulness of the mind, and the fourth one mindfulness of mental phenomena. So I made suggestions that might be helpful in trying to integrate the concept of mindfulness of breathing with the actual training protocol. So I just wanted to put that out there for discussion and maybe refer back to the posted recording and notes from last week as well. So, questions, comments. What did you experience with with the guided meditation, or generally, what's going on with your meditation practice? Let me put on my coaching hat. John Ciccone.
Meditated earlier today. Thought I was going to get a second meditation in, but got tremendously jammed at the Walmart store. It was ridiculous. And then traffic got as ridiculous. And I thought I was calm, but I got upset in the traffic. I got irate. I mean, I was really crazy. As bad as the guy driving in front of me. You know what I mean? He was made the terrible mistake. So it's funny, after only meditating 52 years, and it felt like I had never meditated at all. Just totally
Yeah, I have not been
lost it.
able to achieve total balance myself. In fact, I got a bit angry this morning because my computer decided once again that I had to restart it and re-engage all my programs and go through all the rigmarole of authorizing it and all that stuff. So yeah, but I bring a different sensibility to the experience. I know that there's energy is just surging inside, and there's a part of my mind that's curious about it, doesn't really want to do it. And my wife got up and left the room. When I do not blame her for that, but I couldn't get up and leave the room. So I sat with it and really tried to understand what was going on. And the curiosity, the detached curiosity, kind of dissolved it. And for me, that's one of the the takeaways from the meditation practice. As many times as I've had to let go of some kind of urgency and go back to the breath, this was happening not in the context of a meditation, but in terms of just dealing with life, right? So the practice pays off, but we have to really train for it. Other questions or observations about your experience? Robert?
I've been struggling a bit last week. I aim to do an hour in the morning, hour in the evening, and if I get up early enough, the hour in the morning is quite easy, though, to sit with and do, you know, effectively. But I find the evening, like just now, I'm having issues with sleepiness, which, you know, I sort of struggle with while it's going on, sometimes get on top of it and then slip back.
So let's talk about that. Let's talk about what your experience was with the sloth and torpor. That's the hindrance of sloth and torpor.
Yeah, yeah.
And you were experiencing it tonight?
A bit, yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about it.
I normally bring my own cushion.
Uh-huh.
Tonight I thought, oh, there's loads of cushions there, I'll bring it. But I actually wasn't as comfortable on this as with my own cushion. So I think...
Well, that's the story that your mind tells you about it. Okay, could be a bunch of different conditions.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not disputing that distinction, but your attention is on what was going on outside. Mm. But what can we explore about your dissatisfaction or doubt or whatever it was that you experienced because your mind was not performing up to standard? What was that like for you with the meditation tonight? Can you kind of describe the characteristics of it?
I don't know whether I actually went straight into it quite deep, and it wasn't a struggle to. It was just certain unsleepiness, really, tiredness, and difficulty keeping my hand on the rudder.
Okay, difficulty keeping your hand on the rudder. That's one of the characteristics of sloth and torpor, dullness and non-responsiveness in the mind and in the body, right? So there's that quality. What else were you noticing?
Well, certain discomfort. My foot was hurting because of mm-hmm. the way I was sitting.
Mm-hmm.
So I was okay with it for a while and then had to shift a bit.
So how did your mind...
I mean, when you start watching the breath, and then I seem to go to more watching my thoughts come and go, which is the kind of technique that I favor most.
Mm-hmm. So watching your thoughts come and go...
Then it's not so easy to do.
But were you able to notice that it was still... It's one of the things that's interesting about this practice, that even when the mind is dull, because of the practice, there's an ability, when you discern that the mind is dull, there's a quality of alertness that comes with it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that can be associated with...
That's true, yeah.
That can be associated with how the story begins, whatever the commentary is, right? To noticing that is what the mindfulness of breathing practice involves, right? And basically what you're concerned with is, in the sloth and torpor, is establishing the characteristics of the first tetrad, which is basically your mind is stable and alert, and your body was relatively relaxed, right? Now, when I say that, it's once again, it's circumstantial. Your foot started hurting. That changed the whole mix of things, right? And of course, when dullness occurs, the same thing happens. But with this practice, establishing the breath as a common point of reference, it interrupts the development, the reiteration of dullness, right? or the commentary. It just changes the way you understand what's happening. Or I'll take the you out of it. The way understanding what's happening changes. You start to become aware that this is something that is a function of consciousness. It's not a self. And I realize when I'm saying this, it sounds really abstract, but that's my practice right now. It's really trying to understand that. I have to use words to describe it, but there's this sense of detachment that comes. And what I'm describing right now with my own practice is probably the third tetrad or something, you know, in that zone. I'm more aware of the mind's function. Well, when you're aware of dullness, that's an awareness of the mind's function, right? But I'm kind of putting words to this to try to link it up with what we experienced in the guided meditation, right?
Yeah. I think the past few days has been an absence of firmness and determination, perhaps, as well.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense.
Why not?
But I find when I sit down, there is a strong sense of being drawn inwards, actually. At least now, as soon as I close my eyes and mm-hmm. There is a fit, but I don't know whether that's some kind of imagination or something.
Oh, of course it's imagination, but it's what I will call skillful. I'll call it skillful imagination.
Right.
It's liberating imagination rather than dukkha-generating imagination.
Right.
It's all imagination.
Mm.
You know, we image ourselves and the world. It's a construct. It's not essentially true or real. The process of thinking and being aware is true and real. But what the mind thinks in the selfing process is not real. But it's useful. Satish, you had your hand up.
Where does self-compassion fit in all this?
In terms of the guided meditation, when I was talking about noticing the quality of consciousness, was the mind alert or distracted, overly energetic or tranquil? You know, what's the balance point, right? When the mind is balanced, there's a sense of connectedness. And that connectedness is the foundation for self-compassion.
Now, even when things are not going well, where's the self-compassion there?
There's an awareness that the condition of self-compassion is not available. I mean, that's part of the four foundations of mindfulness,
yeah.
Conceptual structure, to notice when something's present, when it's not present, what the conditions are that support its presence, what are the conditions that support its absence, and so forth and so on. So it's being aware of that.
Yeah, shouldn't that be kind of running through the thread? Self-compassion, whatever is happening, at least you are trying.
Absolutely.
You know, so.
Absolutely. Anytime anybody meditates, it's an act of self-compassion.
Yeah.
Inherently. I mean, that's when we're meditating, even when the mind gets messed up and we go back to the breath, going back to the breath is an act of compassion.
Yeah. Without derating yourself and
right.
I'm not doing it well.
Hi. Right.
Yes, question.
Joe?
I think you would raise his hand first. Yeah.
Right. John?
I simply had the question that a lot of times I catch myself thinking like Robert does, but that I have the breath as my companion, and I've now brought that to the same level as thinking, whereas I can go to the breath and not be controlled by that thought. But if I'm not sitting, I'm not, I don't know what the word is, aware, then I get sucked into that brain eating me lunch.
Yep, not mindful. Joe?
So I was just gonna say about, like, where does the self-compassion come in? And I think when you start to see yourself as not really like a normal human being in the sense, you know, like that you're like when you automatically have compassion for the other people around you, you'll start to see that you're no different
right.
from that. Like, you're not actually doing things. Like, you see that you're exactly the same, and you don't see yourself as any different. And so the compassion you have for yourself is exactly the passion you have for other people, because in actuality, there's nothing else there. There's only you that has compassion. That's why, like, when you're treating other people nice and well, you're treating yourself nice and well, right? Because there's no difference in that. Everything else isn't really there in the sense that you think it's there.
Yep. You're absolutely right, Joe. Absolutely right. And it's a gift. Compassion is a gift to you, to yourself, that is then projected.
And not spontaneous.
Just projected out to the world, in aware that other, we're all in this together. We're all bozos on this bus. It's something, that statement that goes back to the 1960s. So is that helpful, Satish, in terms of your...
Yeah.
So anybody on Zoom have any questions or comments? Yeah, Christy.
Yeah, so I'm willing to share my experience of this meditation session. It was kind of all over the place. I started out a little bit distracted, and it took me a while to settle. And then I started... fading, sloth and torpor set in, which usually happens to me at some point. And then I got alert again, and probably when you started talking, so thank you. And then I think I did the Goenka retreat, and then this Sunday there was a one-day retreat that I attended as well. So I've been mostly focusing on doing the body scan meditations, and I've just started to incorporate the breathing back into it. I start with it now every time, and but this time I just stayed with the breathing.
Describe it. Think out loud about the experience, please. And I'm asking people to do this because when we start to talk about our experience, that starts to make connections in areas of our consciousness, our brain function, that we may not otherwise be able to realize. So describe that, please.
Can you explain what you mean by that? What am I explaining?
When you're meditating and you notice these kinds of experiences,
like
I was suggesting with Robert, what goes on, right? Does your mind seem more alert, or are you noticing a transition from being interested to then being distracted? I mean, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, what happens is when I'm breathing, I tell myself, like you suggest, at the end of the out-breath to say, let go. And that usually works to help me relax. And then as soon as that starts working, that's when I start to sort of drift a little bit, because I'm relaxed. And then I'll catch myself drifting, and I'll try and come back.
How do you catch yourself?
I'm not sure. I'll just be aware all of a sudden that I wasn't present. You know, I was just sort of drifting.
So it was a little bit dreamy. Let me put words to that. You were aware. So there's mindfulness there.
Uh-huh.
Moment awareness.
Yeah.
And there's investigation there. There's the ability to notice the characteristics of whatever was going on. It could be dullness, it could be distraction, whatever.
Yeah. Right?
And then there's the intention to go back to the breath.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the first three of the seven awakening factors. You've heard me talk about this before.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
So
that gets things back on track.
Yeah.
And then you get distracted again.
Right.
As your practice matures, you're more aware that that's what's going on. Like, you know, you're expert at playing the piano. You can notice errors that wouldn't even occur to me in terms of how to strike the keys, right? Because of your engaged practice. And so the same principle applies to investigating and steering the energy of attention in the mind.
Mm-hmm.
So what else was going on?
Oh, well, so at one point, my hair fell in my face and it was tickling my cheek. And I noticed that. And I just decided to feel that and not let it, I didn't want to scratch my face. And so I just decided to feel that as just sensation rather than as anything that would that had like putting any kind of a judgment on it, you know, good, bad, it tickles, I want to make it stop. I just sort of started feeling like it's just a sensation. This is another sensation. And so as I did that, it just became sensation and wasn't bothering me anymore.
So, was there a sense of urgency when the mind would go to, I've got to stop this? Did
At
you notice any
the very
surge of energy?
beginning, yeah, at the very beginning, there was a little bit of a, oh, that tickles.
Right.
I want it to stop. But
No,
then I
that's
just,
the storyline.
yeah.
There's something that goes on. For me, it goes on in the torso mostly. It's where I notice it. This pressure, right? This pressing urgency and reactivity. I mean, it's for me, it's now really noticeable, probably because I've trained myself to be so aware inside. But
Yeah.
there's this surge of energy. And, you know, it's important to be aware of that as well as just the phenomena of hair follicles hitting skin follicles, right? Or hair material hitting skin material. Do you see what I'm talking about there in terms of, you know, your experience with that?
Yeah, you're separating out the what goes on in the mind and then what goes on physically and
Right.
how I perceive it.
Right.
So yeah, I agree. I perceive it sort of in the I perceive it a little bit more in the abdomen area, that sense of urgency and wanting to make it stop or wanting, you know, having a sensation of wanting to do something.
For me, it's more in my chest. And you
And
know,
then
the
I
idea is
just
to notice the urgency. It doesn't matter where it happens.
right. And then I recognize the urgency and I breathe into it and tell myself to relax and just observe.
Let
So
go
that's
with the
what I
out
did.
breath.
Yeah. So
But
that's what I did.
with curiosity, right?
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, okay, this is just a sensation. Let's feel this.
Right.
And it began to change slightly.
Right.
Just that sense of urgency went away and it became just, you know, something I noticed on the surface of my skin.
So one of the things I would suggest to you is that the more your ability to do the body scanning and get into that whole body vibe, the more you can cultivate that, the more clear that sense of urgency becomes. And it's, you know, there's a quality of reactivity to it. But that's the way to free the mind, is just what you were doing.
What did you, when you, I'm sorry, I misunderstood. You said the body scan
Yeah,
creates a sense of urgency?
when you cultivate the whole body awareness, you know, Vedanupassana, the body scanning that Goenka teaches, that develops an internal sensitivity. So that when the urgency comes up, it's more vivid in awareness. And not so much that the idea is for it to be more vivid, but it's the edge of learning how to let go. The more we can let go of that reactivity, the urgency might still be there, although it tends to dissipate. But the mind can rest with what's happening. You know, for me, it's an itch around my nose. That's where I'm
Right.
feeling. Just pretty reliable. It's one of the ways I know that that sitting is getting deeper, is something starts to happen right in this facial area. But more practice is necessary. Satish?
You know, to me, carrying on that, to me, just noticing it is good enough. I think letting it go, there is thoughts involved in it. There is
Thoughts involved in letting go?
Yeah.
Well, there's an inclination to let go, but you don't. The letting go, there can be a thought associated with it.
Yes.
But when you can be able to look deeper, there's a felt sense there also. And that's what I was just talking with Christy about, that felt sense of urgency. It's in the body. There's no story about it. And when you can discern the difference between the two, that's how to cultivate equanimity.
Well, urgency, to me, urgency is you lost equanimity. Mm-hmm. Because of urgency. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So I would just...
That's completely acceptable also.
Yeah.
It's just the idea is to be aware of the intention. What you all couldn't see it. What Satish did was just scratch his neck, right? Assuming, you know, there's an itch there, so you scratch it. But there's an awareness of the scratching. And, you know, perhaps there's a missed opportunity to cultivate equanimity, non-reactivity. But when I make that choice, I'm making it kind of socially now. I get an itch in my face, I scratch it. But I might decide that the quality of my concentration is not what I would like it to be because this is intrusive, this itch on my face. So I'll scratch the itch, but I'll do it very mindfully. And then I'll go back to the deepening, opening process. And then perhaps the next time it comes up, there'll be a balance in my ability to be with it. So I'll just be with it rather than getting rid of it so I can make the mind more stable. I mean, that's part of the practice is learning how to make those process choices on the fly, so to speak.
I'd like to comment.
Yes, Brandon.
There's been a few things about things tickling the face. So I use that. Basically, I have, I don't know, it's basically a place I go when I'm maintaining and I'm not heavily practicing. But once I get the full body buzz, I just sit there and I'm aware of that. But if I get a tickle on my face, then I say, well, does my chin tickle? Or maybe, what about the other side of the cheek? Or does my forehead sparkle? And I'm using that word, but
mm-hmm.
By the time I get to a place where I can feel tingling on the top of my head, and then I can start scanning and feeling that sensation, I guess, on the epidermis as it goes down. Once I'm able to get to a point where I can feel that going down and coming back up, and once the body...
When you say going down, coming back up, you're talking about body scanning.
Yeah, but I'm...
Scanning feeling, down to your feet and then scanning back up. I'm saying that for folks who don't know.
Yeah, so, but there's distinct feeling there that has the quality of that tickle or that itch. It's that strong, but it's not annoying anymore. It's part of the process of going up and down the body, and you're feeling that. And then once the whole body is doing that, I let go of scanning, and I just sit and basically feel, just basically become aware of that body buzz. And I don't know what to call it. But the whole body,
it's called Banga.
The whole body is buzzing, and you just sit, and you're aware of that. And when you,
mm-hmm.
when we're done, you don't want to come out of it. I don't know, I guess it's called Banga, but from my perspective, the thoughts are just, I'm not even worried about my thoughts.
They're in the other room with the door closed.
I'm completely awake. I mean, it is a buzz. It feels like a buzz, and your whole body's doing it.
Yep.
And you're just wide awake like I don't know how to describe it, but I wanted to make that point about using those annoyances differently, even the pain.
Yep.
Using it
a different perspective about them.
Yeah, yeah. If your ear starts to tickle, can I feel my other ear? Can I now feel the top of my head?
And what that means functionally is that there's an intention to direct the energy of your attention into these different areas.
Yeah, because it is interesting.
So,
it's different as it...
Well, it's interesting because the mind is more interested, not because it's inherently interesting, just to kind of tie it together there.
Yeah.
The itch is very interesting, right? But you look on the other side of the face, you bring interest to that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Whether there's an itch or not,
yeah.
You bring an interest to that. And that interest is the investigation factor of awakening.
Yeah.
And when you can persist at it, that's the energy awakening factor of awakening. And, of course, mindfulness is there. So those three functions, they're in the Anapanasati Sutta. They're in the mindfulness of breathing discourse. But this kind of, that's why I wanted to mention at the beginning of the talk, that this is like a training manual. By the way, I posted Analio's translation of the Anapanasati Sutta last week on the website, and along with the posting of the Dharma talk on the Anapanasati. So for those of you who might be interested to go back and check that, that's the translation. So in this context, though, you're learning how to manage how attention flows, right? That's what you're saying.
Yeah.
Whether it's pleasant or unpleasant.
Yeah, because they all blend together eventually.
Yes.
When you get to that point where you can, where you're doing what Goenka's trying to get you to do, or where you're actually feeling, you know, where you're just, I really don't know, I don't have words for it. When you're doing the thing, all of that blends together. The pain in the back and the itch on the face and the sun heat on your forehead type sparkle feeling, that all like blends together eventually, mm-hmm. and just becomes a full body buzzing sensation.
Yep.
Yeah.
And so there's that awareness. That's the still forest pool that I alluded to during the guided meditation. By the way, that's a quote. It's actually the title of a book about Ajahn Chah, Still Forest Pool. But the simile is that quieting your mind is like watching the surface of a pool become very quiet, non-reactive, no ripples. And you can see down into it more clearly. And then all kinds of strange and wonderful creatures come to drink there, which is all the thoughts, all the itches, all the impulses. They come and they create a ripple. But because the mind is really engaged in the stability of the still forest pool, when the ripples happen, you're aware that they're ripples. There's things that are happening. They don't have to be identified as, this is who I am, this is how the world is. Actually, it is how the world is, but, you know, it's just that quality of unification, right? What you were talking about, it all seems to fit together, right? It's all integrated.
Yeah.
Certain point.
Yeah.
That's the concentration awakening factor. And it opens the opportunity for the equanimity awakening factor, the balance, which I alluded to in the meditation, that there's not too much excitement, there's not too much tranquility, it's just the right amount. There's not too much attachment and identification, but there's not too much spacing out. There's an optimal point there, right? And you can find that. And that's what happens when we use the breath sensation. It's like a balancing pole. You're walking down a high wire with a balancing pole, right? That's what the breath-body awareness becomes. I integrate breath awareness even with that whole body scan vibe thing. One of the things I talked about last week was conditioning, right? And there's a certain kind of conditioning that we do to get a result. I can't remember it right now, but operant conditioning. That's what this is. Operant conditioning basically means that you can do a procedure over and over again effectively and awarely. You're doing it because you want a result. And that's what this practice is about. And your intentionality that you were talking about there in terms of how everything comes together is part of that.
I always use breath too, by the way, just to throw that in.
Use what?
The breath. I always use
yeah.
the breath.
Yeah. Good. Good.
To start. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Because of that connection, that function, that association.
Mm-hmm.
Joe, you had your hand up.
Yeah, so I find that there's like different, almost like rooms you go into, as you go into it, there's like different areas. So it's like when you're breathing, you get deeper and deeper. And it doesn't seem like it's like a linear kind of thing. It seems like you're going, you're in one spot, and then and you go deeper, and then it's almost like you're going into it. And then I think, and then it feels like it finally goes to the equanimity that you're talking about when you're kind of like
balanced,
disappear in a way. Mm-hmm. You're, and it seems like I think that's the spot right before you can go into another one, but that's something different. Mm-hmm. But like, and then of course, and you can see the breath disappearing as you go.
Yep.
You become lighter and lighter until you can't.
You're not even breathing.
More, and then you go,
right.
And it goes away almost completely.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
And that's why I still do like I do a breathe in, breathe out, because it seems like the thought, and it becomes very light, the thought, but it seems like that thought.
Yeah, let
itself,
let the thought fade out.
The anchor, right?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because the breath disappears,
mm-hmm.
and then the thought itself almost is very light, you know what I mean? Eventually,
you don't need it anymore.
Right. I mean, there's,
mm-hmm.
there's almost like a wall.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
What do you
yeah.
mean breath disappears?
Yeah.
You're breathing.
So as you breathe in and out, it becomes more and more and more subtle as you go.
Yeah.
And it'll become completely subtle. So the first thing you'll notice is like maybe you can kind of hear your breathing, and then eventually it'll go lighter and lighter where you can't hear your breathing. And then not only that, then
you stop
you're
breathing.
Going to a spot, yeah. I mean,
you just stop
like
breathing.
Yeah, you must be
breathing.
Really
yeah.
getting really deep into it.
Yeah.
Right.
Sounds like.
Yeah, there was an experiment. It was done once. They brought in a really accomplished yogi in the Hindu tradition, and they created an airtight box, and they put a candle in the box, and this is a well-respected community. They put a candle in the box and measured how much time elapsed before it went out because there was no more oxygen, right? And when I say candle, I mean something that was burning fuel, right? Then they had the yogi go in there, and he outlasted the candle. And I can tell you, there when I'm on retreat, well, sometimes when any, not always, but when I'm sitting, I'll stop breathing for some period of time. It's just, or the breathing becomes very, very brief and subtle and soft, right? So it's just what happens when the mind gets quiet. Quiet, and that's actually one of the things that's I think the second the goal of the second tetrad in the Anapanasati Sutta is that the breath becomes very, very quiet and
subtle. Is that like samadhi?
Yeah.
It's a form of samadhi. I mean, like there's many different kinds of samadhis. Like
right.
I was talking about equanimity, and then I think in Buddhism, they call it, like, maybe that would be considered the fourth jhana that you'd be in. I'm not going to go into that.
Yeah,
I don't believe in that stuff. I mean, I'm just talking about...
Oh, jhanas are real.
No, I know, but I'm just saying I don't... There's no distinction, because
right.
I don't really have... I'm just saying, and then it goes...
Right.
And then after that,
yep.
there's a... But anyway.
That's the unification I was talking about, that the mind is unified and very stable, but it's not like a jhana.
Right.
It's all-inclusive. Jhanas are all-exclusive, but... this kind of unification, which is part of the, I think that's the culmination of the third foundation of mindfulness, is that kind of unification, which is sort of what Brandon was describing with that whole body vibe.
Find equanimity.
It's balance.
Right.
Right. John?
I think the balance is more touching the stillness of when you're not thinking as much, and you're just still, and you're able to get, I guess that's what a jhana would be when you get to the stillness, and
no.
it's clear, and you're just there.
Yeah, that's not jhana. That's just there. That's stillness. It's different. The jhana phenomena is very different experientially. But what you're talking about is, yes, it's concentration and it's what Brandon was talking about
it's
as well.
It's when still the thinking stops, and then it's a whole different world.
Yep, it fades out.
Yep.
You don't have to make it shut up. You just lose interest in it, and it fades out.
Yep. That's a good way to put it.
I'm enjoying this conversation. I need some other questions. comments about your practice?
Steve, I have something to Steve. Does that Steve have something?
Robert. Go ahead, Steve Armand.
Oh, Steve, me? Yeah. Steve Perlman, did you have one too?
Yeah, yeah, sure, but go ahead, man.
Oh, yeah. Okay. And also,
you're on.
Your hand was slightly out of frame. That's why we couldn't see it. I was like half a hand. I have a problem staying in frame too. Anyway, yeah, no, I was thinking about what we were talking about, and I tend to also gauge where I'm at in the practice, not by the actual experience meditating, but how often I get activated, and meaning that, you know, ruminate or something, nervous system gets activated by something, whatever, get upset, whatever it is. I think we know what we mean by becoming activated at something. Peter, you mentioned this morning. What that activation experience is like, I think is a reflection of where I'm at in the practice. Because I tend to think about the practice as an all-day sort of thing, kind of like how you teach us in retreats. You know, we go on walking meditations and we meditate. Anyway, when I have a sensation that I'm kind of split on it, in other words, I have the observer there as I'm being activated that knows that this rumination is temporary, give it a beat, whatever, you know, you do anything. But you drift sometimes into the activation and out of it. Like you feel it, like you're kind of trapped and you're about to get angry or act out on it. And then you kind of see the observer as well. I think the more I'm able to be aware during an activation on a given day or a given week, the more likely I'm able to have a cleaner, as I would like to say, investigation while I'm sitting or practicing. And where I'm at with it is that my investigations are enjoyable. I know that's not always the point, PT or whatever, but that's kind of its own deal. But that's where I'm at. I really enjoy, especially when first waking up, just all the bodies, investigating the body shortly after awakening. That's great. And I don't, it's one thing about the investigation being enjoyable lately is I don't tend to get discouraged when I get distracted very much. That's one game I kind of choose not to play. But I think it kind of feeds on itself. The more I practice, the more likely I am to, the less likely I am to be sharply activated by something, where I'm caught more in the activation than the observation of the activation.
Let me comment on that in two ways. We often talked about the straws that broke a camel's back. Everybody pays attention to the last straw as if that was the only problem. What about all the other straws? So we live in a stressful environment. So we carry a lot of unnecessary straws of preoccupation, desire, aversion, et cetera, et cetera. The more regularly we sit, the more we can identify and let go of unnecessary straws, to recognize that they're really not as important as the mind wants them to be, right? So there's that aspect of it. The other aspect is that as the mind kind of gets less stirred up, you can look deeper. And so it's not so much, it's more about understanding the characteristics of each straw rather than noticing and dumping them, so to speak.
Yeah, you actually investigate, just like you investigate body sensations, you investigate sort of the nuances of the activation. If it's somebody that said something or whatever, something like that. So I think that's fascinating. And I also, I'm a big believer in the more I intentionally subject myself to exciting and scary life changes and weird social situations, self-imposed potential activation, the better I get with activation, the better I get with practice. I'm a big believer in that. Having a therapist helps me. And I also, just in closing there, I something I find very useful for ChatGPT is I keep an activation log. Whenever I get activated, I start speaking in the ChatGPT, and that thing that has at least has no resentment or whatever will just kind of remove the noise and separate sometimes the noise from the actual thing. I find ChatGPT very useful for diffusing activations.
Yeah, anyway, I use it for research. I definitely use it for research. And I'm an informed consumer. Some of what I get is not useful, not accurate, but I find
it. Yeah, it's a craft in how to use it. It's blessing and a curse.
Yeah, it depends on how you phrase the questions, actually. A lot of it depends on that. So how about the other Steve, and then we'll go to Robert.
Oh, all right. Nice studio, Steve. What I find really remarkable is just how difficult it is to be mindful and stay present with whatever the object is. And that differs for me depending on whether I'm in a retreat where I'm practicing and practicing and practicing and can then stay for a long period of time, you know, just focused and detached with whatever that object is. And sometimes it's just fascinating, and you do get that granularity that you're talking about. But otherwise, in just general society, having just so many things that you're thinking about, so many things to do, places to go, that, you know, when I do try to practice like tonight, just pulled out. I come back and I can be mindful, but just for a short period of time before just getting pulled out again. And what I find extraordinary is just how much time you can really spend being checked out and not Lose mindful control. At all.
That's one of the problems of sitting a lot. It's really easy to get into cruise control, get comfortable and relatively peaceful, but not as alert as the practice would benefit from. So that's an important thing to be able to notice when it's happening and do something to bring more alertness to the moment, so to speak.
Well, I think that's why you say, of course, you know, that more practice is needed.
Yep.
And why it really takes a lot of determination to get there.
Yep. So back to the conversation earlier about the itch, as I've been talking with Steve II here, Steve Perlman, itch came up on my left cheek. But what was interesting, and this is something I've worked with while I'm meditating, is there were some times when I was really aware of that sensation and this subtle felt sense of urgency. I can notice it right now because the itch is still there. But then I would notice that my mind was more engaged in what the implications of what Steve was talking about. So the sensation would kind of fade out, right? The signal strength got really weak, and then it would come back again and then get really weak. And that's an insight to impermanence, right? To notice that the mind can jump track. It's what seems to be so important for a period of time. Suddenly the mind has danced off into something else. And what was so important just a moment ago, is I'm barely aware of it, not at all interested. And then it comes zooming back in again. Being able to notice that with detachment, that's insight into impermanence, but it's also insight into the fluidity of the self. You know, the self is not a solid state. It's dynamic. And that's an insight into anatta, the absence of an enduring autonomous self. So that's also an important aspect of this. You had another comment, Steve?
Those are interesting opportunities. When you don't react, right? When you're able to just be detached with it and just watch, well, what really is happening?
Yes. Yes. Including what the mind is making you. Very important part of it. Robert?
It was just an observation, really. I'm not sure if it's worth even mentioning, but one of the things I have is that I have a problem settling on which technique I'm going to use. So I can keep a candle flame. I'm surprised how stable I can keep a candle flame going for a while. And then there's the breathing. And there's also the mind watching. And I suppose that it's perhaps a Gemini thing that you keep going backwards and forwards between different techniques instead of picking one.
We're both guilty of that then, sir.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah.
Well, you're...
4th of June.
Yeah, there you are, yeah. 3rd of June. But that's that, I suppose. But the other thing is, I've been reading the Alan Wallace book, which is superb. I'm still reading it, and I'll give it back to you. Mm-hmm. But and he was mentioning the mind becoming quiescent.
Yes.
And I've done this before. Sometimes if your mind can be busy, just... saying to yourself, well, what would it be like if my mind was quiescent? Seems to carry you part of the way towards it.
Right.
Just bringing it into an imagination of what it would be like can be quite effective, I think.
Up to a point. I mean, it's completely legitimate, but there comes a point when we have to let that go. Like with the body scanning that Brandon was talking about. But also that expectation.
Yeah.
To just let that go. And whatever comes up, that's it. But the mind is so quiet that there's a quality of curiosity and non-attachment with what's going on.
Yeah.
Right? Now, that doesn't mean that we walk around oblivious in the world. It just means that there are fewer straws on our backs when we do walk around the world. So we're in a better position. And, you know, I talked about losing my temper this morning. It happens fewer and fewer times. It doesn't last as long. And it's not as severe. But it's still there. And it's not like, what's the matter with me? I should be beyond this. More along the lines of, wow, look at this. Isn't this interesting? Rather than, you know, it's self-compassion again. You know, I mean, one thing that I read once that Onalio said that, you know, his obstacle has always been his anger. So I can very much relate to that. You know, my frustration with the imperfection of myself and the world. Right. So this practice allows us to kind of investigate that in ways that I think are really liberating.
And if the mind, if you're thinking quiescent, the mind isn't quiescent, but it's at least you're setting up some kind of, setting up some kind of conditions.
That's where the body awareness is so useful.
Yeah.
Because the more you can use the breath-body interaction to let go into sensory experience, mindfulness of breathing, just as it is, the less intrusive and impactful the whatever the commentary is. So it might be useful to have an initial commentary, like let go, or something like that. But after a while, there's more reliance on what can be explored with the opening of the body, with the letting go in the out-breath. And the need to put a term to it, it just falls off the map.
I think sometimes there can be a combination. Instead of sticking doggedly because, you know, you've read in a book that that's the way to do it, to actually explore and be open to different combining different techniques.
Yeah.
It can be just as effective. And, you know, sort of saying, well, what do I want to do? You know, instead of, you know, what someone else is doing, which is fine.
Yeah, it's important to study what someone else is doing, but you know, the last words out of the Buddha's mouth was not follow me. It was work out your own salvation with diligence and all the different techniques that are available. And actually, I think the Buddha said that there are hundreds of ways to concentrate the mind.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Interesting.
And so that's been the story of my experiences, that I've sat with lots of different teachers with different styles, different instructions, but now I have my own and I'm sharing it with you all, right? So I think it's incumbent on us all to do that, but also to be willing to pay attention to what somebody else has to say.
Yeah.
And kind of pull it all together. Yes, Joe?
Yeah, I was just going to expound on that a little more. Like, right, it seems like when you get angry or something like that, like the other might have other problems, you know? It's just such a good opportunity because then you can stop the thinking and then look at yourself, kind of like when you're doing the meditation, and then you're like, where is that? You know what I mean? Where is the anger? And you look in, and then you'll find that there's nothing there, you know? And as you look, and you look for it,
yep,
it seems to just disappear. It's kind of like in the Heart Sutra kind of thing. Like, it's just, like, it's...
Form is emptiness, emptiness is form.
Right, and you can just see that there's nothing there.
Yeah.
And as you look for it, then it just tends to disappear. You know,
yeah.
And you can,
yeah.
Anger is emptiness, and emptiness is anger.
Yeah, you can actually see that it's not.
Yeah.
It's not. It is an illusion, you know, and that it often starts in the body, and goes in the mind, but then the mind creates it in the body, and it's like,
yep.
One starts the other starts the other.
Yeah, they're mutually reinforcing. Absolutely.
Once you start becoming aware of it and observing it, it sort of almost can't survive for very long, can it? It becomes like just a thing.
It's
not you.
Right, it's like a mind object.
Yeah.
It's like an object outside of you.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
just inside your head, which isn't, I mean, like, you know, that's not, we're not touching it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, this practice, this mindfulness of breathing practice, there's a certain quality of attention that we're trying to cultivate. I've been talking about it all night. But the idea is that we have to use some degree of reactivity in terms of noticing when the mind is away from the breath and then going back to the breath. But the more we can do that and the more generally stable and quiet the functions of awareness are, the easier it is to not feel the need for any kind of commentary. Any kind of instruction, I think that's the culmination of the third tetrad, is that the process of being aware becomes more persistent and integrated and beneficial, right? That it's not like it's a habit, but it's a well-established routine. It's a familiar protocol that we can follow. And I think that's important as well, is that, yeah, we need to have words, concepts, to get the thing going. But there comes a time, and this is really what the fourth tetrad emphasizes in the Anapanasati, is there comes a time when it's no longer about any kind of commentary or identification. It's just openness. Undifferentiated, non-reactive, all-inclusive openness. And for me, I find that to be a very interesting proposition. Satish?
I'm curious. I'd like to know, from your point of view, why do we meditate?
Go back to an early conversation this evening. My life was in a great deal of upheaval, and my identity was being severely challenged by life circumstances, my sense of self-respect and confidence and all that. And someone gave me a book for Christmas, by Joseph Goldstein. And it was like, oh, this is it. This is what I'm going to do. And that was Christmas of 81. And I went to my first retreat in Massachusetts in April of 82. So it was my own need for self-awareness and to kind of reboot the system, so to speak.
Let me rephrase the question. I was asking in general, why do we meditate? But since you brought it up, why do you meditate?
Because I'm less reactive.
Okay.
I have more patience.
Okay.
I love the elegance of the Dharma. It just makes so much sense to me that it's like really admiring a piece of music and loving to play it over and over and over again because of its brilliance. There's something that's really brilliant about that whole conceptual structure and the training. I mean, I've been sitting twice a day for 20 years now.
So why does it make you less reactive?
Fewer straws on my back, and the more aware, there are fewer straws on my back.
Okay.
And not only in terms of mental preoccupations, but my lifestyle is simpler. My lifestyle is not as stressful or complicated as it used to be.
So
part of that's because I'm retired, but that began way before I got retired.
So why does meditation make you carry fewer straws?
Because every time the mind gets wrapped around something, whether it's something you want or something you fear, it changes the way your process operates, and it adds more straws to your back. A person adapts. Any organism will adapt. You know, there's a story about you can put a lobster in a pot of water, and it has an opportunity to escape, and you keep raising the temperature 1 degree at a time, and eventually it's boiling, and the lobster doesn't even know it, right? So we're all deeply conditioned. There are a lot of straws on our back about being consumers, about our status in society and relationships and all that stuff, health. So all these things... our straws on our back. But when I can recognize the felt sense of urgency about an itch on my face, that's a kind of a protocol that I can apply to some annoyance that used to bother me or something I felt like I needed to have before that really isn't that important.
Yeah, so that's what I think. Meditation makes you more aware, makes you more present, and then it puts a distance between yourself and whatever is normally bothers
right.
you.
Right.
So there is a gap that,
yep.
that you're
yep.
not as reactive then.
Yeah, one of my teachers, Charlotte Catherine, calls it the potent pause.
Yeah, right.
Right. There's this, like, that's what I mean when I say it's in the door with the other, it's in the other room with the door closed.
Yeah.
There's this felt sense of urgency or storyline, and it's just not interesting anymore. This morning, I got hooked. But okay, this is it. More practice is necessary. This is what it feels like to be hooked. This is the effect it has on people I love, including my dog, who was not all that happy with this either. But it was something I could, you know, I'm not necessarily trying to get rid of it. It's very unpleasant. But I think the more I understand this practice conceptually and the more I train myself with it, like I said before, it doesn't happen anywhere near as frequently as it used to.
Yeah.
Yes, Joe.
Yeah, I was just going to go again more on that. Like, because I find, like, if I do the meditation and stuff too, and at first you'll see all those intrusive thoughts coming in, right? And then you learn, like, you can say that you're learning to kind of ignore them or move on or move past them or however, but you can also look at it as, like, who is having those thoughts?
Right.
Because those thoughts are just arising.
Yeah.
Right? So you're not having them. They're just arising.
They have you.
Right. And then you can take that and you can pull that into your ordinary life when you try to use mindfulness. And you'll see if you're just trying not to, well, if you're just not thinking, you'll see how these thoughts are just arising. Yeah. You know, they're just coming up. Like, once again, you're not having the thought.
Yeah.
It's whether you're engaging in that thought, you know, and how often you have that thought, you're more likely to engage in it. Mm-hmm. And so once you can see that in your meditation and in your own life, then you can start choosing more, you know what I'm saying? And so I think that combination, so the balance of the mindfulness and meditation often really helps balance the two out, because they're, once again, they go on from each other.
You can keep you can use it to catch yourself all day, can't you?
Right.
You can use it all day to keep, and the more you catch it, the more it becomes a habit,
right.
And you find you're doing it all the time.
Right, you'll have a half a thought, and you'll just stop it, you know, and it'll just go.
Can I? Is it too late?
Yeah, we've run way over, actually. It's a good conversation, but we'll put a check on it. I want to be doing an open mic night, an open Dharma questions night in a couple of weeks, so we can continue to talk about this. It's great fun, but I don't want to stay too far over, because some people have already left the Zoom meeting. Next week, Susan's going to talk about self-compassion. So that I'm looking forward to that. It's our custom at the end of our meetings to sit together in silence briefly. So let's do that. Thank you for your practice. I wish you well. Hope we're all reasonably safe and happy till the next time we have a chance to chat.
Thank you.